Welcome to the Ed Wood DVD. In this commentary track, you will hear the voices of Tim Burton, Scott Alexander, Larry Karaszewski, Martin Landau, Colleen Atwood, Stefan Chopsky, and thousands of ghouls. Tim Burton.
Yeah, I saw Ed Wood films on TV. I mean, and I think the first one I saw was probably Plan 9 from Outer Space, because that was the most infamous one, and that would show a lot on Saturday afternoon, Saturday night. And, you know, long before I knew anything about film, you knew that they were special. You know, you knew that they really, they were like weird dreams, you know, because of the sort of weird seriousness, the weird overly poetic, the kind of badness of them was also part of what made them special and good, and that you know, it was kind of the first thing that made you realize there's a real razor's edge between something that's good and bad, because they were powerful, and I mean, people would laugh at them and all, but they were deeper than that somehow. You know, they had a weird dreamlike power to them. The other thing that gave it a dreamlike quality, I have to say, which added power to me, is I grew up in Burbank, and they describe Burbank in Plan 9, and I lived near a cemetery. So I actually thought, when I first saw it, that it was almost like a weirdly real movie, because all the locations, the houses looked like the neighborhood I grew up in. They talked about the cemetery down the street, which I lived by a cemetery down the street. All of the dynamics of it, it looked and felt like it was actually happening. So that gave it an extra power as well. And I realized as I got older that I do have a love of what, I mean, some people consider bad movies, but I never really considered them bad movies. There's something more exposed and vulnerable about them. And somebody who has a sort of definite style. I mean, you could look at one of his films and so to see sort of a distinct style, you know, you can't completely say it's bad, you know? There is some power to that when you can sort of identify a person's work.
Scott Alexander.
Like most people, I first became aware of Ed Wood from the Medved Brothers books. Around 1980, they put out a book called The 50 Worst Films of All Time, and then after that, they claimed to have held an election. And based on the results, they put out a new book called The Golden Turkey Awards. And in that book, Ed had been nominated and elected Worst Director of All Time, as well as having made the worst film of all time, Plan 9 from Outer Space. So then the Medved started cashing in on this Ed Wood phenomenon they had created, and they put together a traveling show of Glenn or Glenda, Bride of the Monster, and Plan 9 from Outer Space, and they would sort of book this triple feature at revival houses around the country, and audiences would show up and hoot and holler and make fun of Ed Wood, and the Medveds would go up on stage between shows and make sneering comments about the ineptitude of Ed Wood. And this was the state of his fandom at that time. And my second year of college, I actually put together a proposal for a documentary called The Man in the Angora Sweater, which was going to be a look at his life. And part of the class was you had to put together budgeting proposals and sort of letters and documents to impress fictitious backers. So I made up fictitious letters from Vampire and Lyle Talbot saying they were very excited that somebody had remembered their contributions to film history and would be very excited to work on this non-existent movie.
Larry Karaszewski.
Scott and I met in 1981. Strangely enough, when we met, we met having a conversation about another grade Z filmmaker. We were both students at USC. We were standing in line, and we didn't know each other. And I don't know who started talking about it first, but Scott was aware that the New Art Theater in Los Angeles was about to show a triple bill of Herschel Gordon Lewis movies. And he had never seen or really heard much about Herschel Gordon Lewis before. And I had grown up in the Midwest. And I had seen everything Herschel Gordon Lewis had done. So I was basically holding court on Herschel Gordon Lewis, and that's how Scott and I became friends. My introduction to Ed Wood was really actually goes back to almost Herschel Gordon Lewis again. When my parents got divorced, my dad got me One Night a Week, and my dad sort of didn't know what to do with the kid, so I kind of manipulated him to take me to the drive-in every weekend. And so we'd go to the drive-in, and he would fall asleep, and I'd sit there and watch all these Roger Corman and AIP movies. But for some reason, this is the mid-70s, Bride of the Monster was the third feature, and I remember at the time being like, why on earth are they showing this black and white Bela Lugosi movie at the drive-in? You know, it was really strange. Clearly somebody, some distributor had a print, and there was some reason it was being run, and I never could figure it out, but it wasn't until years later that, you know, once again, what Scott was saying about the when the Medved brothers brought Ed Wood to fame, that I put the two together.
Also, Ed Wood's movies never seemed to have clear ownership, and they would be picked up by companies that would immediately go bankrupt. And so it was probably easy for drive-in theaters just to get hold of a print and run it without having to pay a license fee to anybody.
Change your ways, and
I mean, there are a lot of these, you know, directors with a body of work of sort of forgotten, forgettable, cheapo movies. I mean, where Ed's movies are distinctive is that there's such a passion there, and the passion is oftentimes misguided. But you look at a movie like Glenn or Glenda, which is rather astonishing considering it was intended to be exploitation, and it really is just about a man kind of tearing his heart out and throwing his emotions up there for 62 minutes, and you sort of scratch your head saying, what possible audience was this movie intended for?
Right, there's a personality to the Ed Wood films that you don't necessarily get in a lot of these other people's films. A lot of bad films are simply bad movies, you know, or incompetently put together. With Ed, you get a real sense of the filmmaker behind the camera. It is the auteur theory. I mean, you can watch an Ed Wood movie and instantly know it's an Ed Wood movie just because of the obsessions and the fetishes and you know, the stuff that he's throwing up on the screen. Is clearly, you know, he's working something out inside of him, where a lot of these people, like, you know, William One Shot Bodine, I'm not quite sure if that's the case. He's just a sloppy filmmaker.
Honey, what if I'm wrong? What if I...
Nobody had his style. I mean, his...
Orson Welles.
It's there, and it does sort of, in a weird way, it does translate to the screen. I mean, it is an odd form of transforming. From film to film, there was a thread of his language and his sort of themes. I mean, that's the thing that I liked about certain films. I mean, even in a film like Plan 9, it's not like Glenn or Glenda, but... You know, you can see the sort of symbols and things that are, you know, things that are important to him. And I mean, that's something that I always tried to do in any film, whether it's a big film or a small film. You know, you have your own kind of cryptic messages in there, or cryptic things that most people wouldn't understand but are kind of important to you. You know, things that you don't even verbalize to the studio or anybody, but kind of keep you going through the process. And you can see that in his films, that kind of cryptic symbols and things that you know are things that are important to him, but they're sort of done under the guise of a genre film or whatever.
We stumbled into making this movie after our problem child experiences. The second script we wrote after college was Problem Child, and the movie got taken away from us, and our sort of what we considered to be a sophisticated adult comedy got turned into sort of a kiddie comedy. And the movies were extremely successful, and there was a sequel and a cartoon show and a TV movie spinoff, but the movies really weren't very good. And we started talking about how amazing it is that you can work for years and years trying to make a movie. And no one's setting out to make a bad movie. Everyone wants to make a good movie. But it's hard to make good movies because there's so many variables and there's so many people involved and so many things that can go wrong. And it's really hard, you know, when the film shows up in a theater a couple years later that everything turned out right. And we started talking about Ed Wood and saying, well, you know, he wasn't trying to make bad movies. He was trying to make good movies just like we were. You know, we didn't set out to make Problem Child. We just ended up making Problem Child. And he didn't want Plan 9 to be the worst movie ever made. It just was. Right. And maybe that passion should count for something.
Right. And basically we were at a point in our career that even though we wrote these these hits, nobody particularly wanted to really work with us because we were the guys who wrote the Problem Child movies. We would get offered kiddie comedy kind of movies, but it wasn't really the kind of movies that we wrote. And I remember actually going into an executive's office one day and pitching an idea with Scott, and the executive saying, "Oh my gosh, that's a great idea for a movie, but you guys aren't good enough to write it." And we sort of walked out of that thing saying, "Oh my gosh, we're not good enough to write our own ideas," you know. And it was like a stake through the heart. And so we sort of walked around ashen for like about a 3-month period, and we sort of decided to kind of redo our career. We both said that, started thinking that maybe we'd got off in the film industry on the wrong foot, that we should have, you know, kind of written that movie from our heart to begin with instead of doing the whole Problem Child route. And we decided that we were just going to back away from the commercial side of it. We thought we'd write this movie about Ed Wood, and we would try to raise independent financing and get it done for, you know, $1 million or whatever. It was, you know, we really envisioned it as a low budget kind of movie. And at that time, a good friend of ours who we also knew from film school, a guy named Michael Lehman, was coming off an experience on a movie called Hudson Hawk, and where he just totally got slammed in the press and the movie died. And we hooked up with him and we said, wouldn't it be funny if the director of Hudson Hawk and the writers of Problem Child, you know, made a movie about the worst filmmaker of all time? And we would be writing about what we know. And so when we hooked up with Michael Lehman suggested going to a producer named Denise DeNovi, who he had made a movie called Heathers with. And we also knew Denise, and Denise had just recently partnered up with Tim Burton. And the idea here would be that if Tim Burton put his name on our Ed Wood script, like a bit of a Tim Burton Presents, it would be easier to get the financing for a low-budget film. And so we thought that was a great idea. And basically we gave a treatment to Burton, and Burton got extremely excited about it. He really loved it, and he actually wanted to direct the movie himself. And so him and Michael had a long conversation. Michael was about to go off to direct a movie called Airhead, so basically him and Tim agreed to swap places, that Tim would direct it and Michael would be one of the producers, but the agreement would be that it would have to be Tim's next movie. The only thing was, at that point, there wasn't a script. It was just, you know...
His next movie. Tim's next movie was supposed to be Mary Riley, which was about to be greenlit at TriStar. And so Larry and I, being mercenaries, said, well, if we can write this movie in 6 weeks before Tim contractually has to sign the other contract, then maybe we can knock Tim out of Mary Riley and get him to make our freaky little project instead.
Right, so Scott and I basically camped out at Scott's apartment and just worked nonstop. And in 6 weeks, we had a draft. It was longer than a script is supposed to be. It was about 148 pages. And we talked about maybe cutting some things, but we decided it was better just to get it into Tim as quick as it could. And basically, we turned it in on a Friday, and by Sunday night, he had called. Tim had called us, and this was like, he loved the script. It was going to be his next movie. This is what he wanted to do, and he didn't have any notes. He really just thought the script was fine the way it was, and he wanted to shoot a first draft. He felt like if you went in there and started changing things incrementally, the script would go further and further away from the story of this lovable loser.
So you think this qualifies you to make my movie?
Yes. I know what it's like.
I thought the script was great. I mean, I really... And it was probably the first time that I ever got a script that I said, yeah, you know, let's shoot this. Because I felt very close to it. I mean, you know, as delusional aspects, you know, when they're looking at the reviews for the play that they did... we're very close to not only Beetlejuice, but like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I mean, I got some of the... Pee-wee's Big Adventure got some of the worst reviews I've ever heard. And same with Beetlejuice, you know, which actually was kind of cathartic because it made me, you know, not get too big-headed about the whole thing, you know what I mean? So, but I that's why I still feel close to that character, because I really, you know what? I hope at the end of all of it, I can still maintain some of that Ed Wood enthusiasm, you know, throughout all of the crap, you know. So this is probably, for me, the least improv'd in terms of from a script point of view, which I enjoyed because, you know, then you had freedom to improvise on other aspects of it. Now, it was kind of, it was nice for a change to actually take a script and just do it like the script. Eye.
I've never had any complaints.
This is the most uncomfortable coffin I've ever been in.
The next thing was to do it in black and white. You know, that was the final hurdle in it, which was, you know, we pretty much went to every studio in town. And finally with Disney, they said reluctantly yes. But it just needed to be.
When we wrote the script, we always imagined that the movie was probably going to be in color, whatever. That people make.
How you imagine most movies.
Exactly. You figure the movie would be in color. Although, strange enough, my wife, Emily, the first time she read it, she said this movie should be in black and white. And I was like, honey, this movie's got enough trouble as it is. We got transvestites, we got, you know, all these other problems. And what happened was, Tim was working with Rick Baker trying to get the makeup right for Martin Landau. And it looked pretty good, but there was something not right about it. They kept on looking at the
they kept saying, what color should the eyes be?
Yeah.
And they're like, I don't know. And they realized, we've never seen a color picture of Bela Lugosi. And then when the dailies got transferred, Tim went up to the monitor and he turned off the color on the TV. He said, now it looks like Lugosi.
And that's how the movie became black and white.
When you take away color, you focus more on what it needs to be, the characters, the period. But it was quite difficult because, you know, they all sorts of reasons against it. And I think, unfortunately, because the film wasn't successful, it kind of, unfortunately, fed into, you see, you know, if it had been in color, maybe it would have been a different story. So it kind of falls into that category of thinking. But I felt lucky to be able to do it in black and white because it's part of the character of it.
Remember when Tim told us he was going to shoot it in black and white, we sort of reacted as a mixed blessing. We knew right away, aesthetically, artistically, it's going to be amazing to see this film in black and white, but we knew right off the bat, this is going to eliminate 90% of our audience. People are going to be more afraid to see this film now because it's a weird movie that's going to look weird. You know, but we ended up with, a more artistically satisfying film.
Today it's all giant fox.
Stefan Chomsky.
And I had shot two other films for Tim, you know, Batman Returns and Edward Scissorhands before that.
Castles.
It had already been decided that it would be black and white, you know.
They are the poet.
You know, that was a fight I wasn't involved in. The only thing I went to fight for was that they would process the film in New York City, which is
the pure heart.
It's not asking a small thing, you know, they don't have to be in Los Angeles. But it just happened to be that the laboratory, the facility that did all the exceptional black and white work, you know, the Woody Allen movies, you know, probably that Raging Bull movie, still developed the black and white negative, and it did it in Boston sometimes even, not in New York, was Duart. I wanted my chance to make a film that really added to the heritage of black and white filmmaking. You know, it was actually my opportunity. I think I knew that when I did it that I might never get another chance to do it. I think that the chance to do it the way I got to do it is not maybe that easy to get anymore. You know, and I feel very, very you know, happy to talk about it, you know, because I actually invested a lot of, you know, work in it. I didn't talk to Tim. He didn't really say it's something that I really surmised by observing what was going on. He felt that it wouldn't be right for this to be like a really prepared film. He wanted it to be different. He wanted it to really, he wanted to make it like an Ed Wood film, you know.
Robert Taylor?
No. You're mixing different elements. You're trying to give a flavor of Ed Wood, but not, you know, but not be Ed Wood exactly. So, you know, we just basically took it scene by scene, blocked. You know, I've learned by that point, you know, when you're working with certain kind of actors, you don't think too, you know, you like to work the scenes out with them. So, you know, we just take it pretty much. We get to wherever the set or location we were in. We would block out the scene with the actors. Stefan would be there or come into it, you know, and then kind of look at the general blocking of the scene and then light it and shoot it. But I didn't, like, go too far with that until we blocked it with the actors, because that's where the energy was. And he was very good at then looking at it, and then we'd discuss, you know, based on what the actors were doing, what kind of performances and all of that, the type of shots, angles, lenses, all of that sort of thing. But, you know, we took it much more spontaneously. It probably doesn't help him much, because it probably takes longer to light. You know, I mean, in some ways you're not able to prepare too much in advance, but it definitely seemed appropriate for this to do it that way.
Actually, we're in that house. The house they shot from the outside, we shot inside. It's a really tiny little house. A poor guy, like, lived there. But I set the camera there, and I don't move the camera. It's just locked off. What advantage that gives me is I have a top of the frame and a left of the frame and a right of the frame. That's where I have to put my lights, like, where they're not in the shot. And I did this with a bunch of little spotlights, a bunch of little lights that get pushed right out to the edge of the frame. I had a really good, gaffer. John Vecchio was a gaffer. John Cassidy was a grip. I had my own system. There's, like, spotlights all over the place in the background. Then I put two lights, one for Johnny and one for Bella, to do this TV effect. And what I got perfect, was so happy about, was, but Bella does this thing with his hands, this kind of chant, and Johnny mimics it. He's not looking at Johnny's face, but the shadow falls right on his face. Because part of it is that you have the light set exactly right, but also he's doing it perfect, you know.
White Zombie, starring Bela Lugosi.
Martin Landau. One of the things I said to Tim, what you've got here is a 74-year-old Hungarian morphine addict, alcoholic, who has mood swings. I mean, that would be, you know, a Hungarian character. That would be hard enough. But he has to be Bela Lugosi, who everyone knows. I said, you know, this could be the worst thing that ever happened. I grew up with guys doing, you know, Frank Gorshin and other, you know, David Fry, better than mouth to drink your blood. You know, Jack Carter, everyone, all the comics were doing Lugosi because he was, you know, fair game. But, I mean, I wanted to humanize him, and yet it needed a style on top of it. It needed a theatricality, and it's a Tim Burton movie. It's not a documentary. my aim was to make him sad and funny at the same time, without ridiculing him. I wanted it to be an homage, a love letter to him, because I became a big fan of his when I watched his movies. And I realized in some of the worst turkeys I've ever seen, he was there doing it. And, I mean, there's a movie called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla that I think makes the Ed Wood movies look like Gone with the Wind. I watched it 3 times in a row because I couldn't believe it. It was so awful. There's nothing redeeming in this movie, except in Lugosi, who's taking this whole thing seriously, because he had to, and it only makes it funnier.
We felt that a lot of people make mistakes when they do biopics, that they have to tell the whole story. And they have to say where the guy was born, and they have to show him as a little child, and then they have to show him dying at the end. And we're sort of saying, well, in real movies, you don't do that. In a normal movie, you just sort of focus on the interesting period in the character's life. And so he said, why is Ed Wood remembered? He's remembered because of the Lugosi movies. You know, as much as we'd like to defend the whole body of work, people don't watch The Sinister Urge as much as they watch Plan 9 from Outer Space. And so we said, well, let's focus on the Lugosi years, which was about a 5-year period. And
in all honesty, those were the years that actually interested us, because we always felt, even from the very beginning, that the heart of the movie was going to be the relationship between Ed and Bella.
You know, but what happens is, by focusing on a period, you immediately are sort of picking the tone of the movie, because Ed's life really went south after the Lugosi years.
We sort of discarded any non-Lugosi projects that Ed was working on during that time. And in reality, I believe The Violent Years and The Sinister Urge are also made during this time period. But
I can't remember.
But we decided not to contradict him at all and really just make it about the two men.
Some people said that Ed Wood was taking advantage of Lugosi. He was a drug addict and he was a fallen man. And then Ed would, you know, wave, you know, $1,000 bills in front of him and say, "Can you show up on my set next Wednesday?" You know, and Lugosi knew these movies really weren't up to the standard of Dracula. You know, but Ed wasn't trying to take advantage of him. Ed just was making the movies Ed wanted to make, and these were the parts he had available for him.
Yes, it's going to be
Martin. Somebody suggested him, and I thought, well, of course. And I didn't know Martin. But I had this feeling about it, and I thought about it later, and I think it really stemmed from, here's a guy that's been through everything, you know? I mean, he's worked with Alfred Hitchcock, you know? He's also been on Gilligan's Island with the Harlem Globetrotters, you know? So he's been the full gamut of, like, doing these amazing things to doing, and so I just felt like, well, here's somebody who's really going to understand what the whole Bella thing, you know, and the whole dynamic of somebody who's done all this great stuff and then goes through all these different, you know, ups and downs. And the great thing about Martin is he's gone through all these ups and downs and always seems to remain on an up. And so he certainly had the passion, and I just felt completely like he completely got that dynamic of it. And after the first makeup test, you know, he just got into it, and you know, the gestures, the physical side of it, the pain, the emotion, all of that, you know, you can't really tell somebody to do that. Something that's why their experience is important, and that's why I felt like, well, he'd be just so great at it.
Oh, I'll read it as soon as I get home.
When we gave Tim the treatment early on, the only thing he said to us was, be careful with the cross-dressing. And well, I don't think it was because Tim was you know, that was bothered by the cross-dressing. I just think he didn't want to make...
He didn't want to make something like it hot.
Yeah. Oh, isn't it funny? A guy wearing a dress. He also didn't want the movie to turn into Priscilla, Queen of the Desert either. You know, the cross-dressing was a major part of Ed's life, but I think he just didn't want it to take over the movie. So it was just a big joke that here's this guy in a dress.
And for such a loony concept, it's actually played really deadpan in the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way Tim shoots it, very matter of fact, and the way Johnny plays it, it's just like, okay, yeah, here I am. I happen to be in a dress. Okay, so what were we talking about?
It's more played for, as the movie Glenn or Glenn is, as a cry for tolerance. It's like, please accept me for who I am. I'm just a guy who likes to wear dresses. And it's basically a rhyming scene with this one, because Sarah sort of flips out, where Patricia Arquette just, you know, accepts it. And the fact that she can accept the fact that he's a cross-dresser and not put him down for it. Since I was a kid.
The interesting thing about Ed is that he wasn't gay. He was a transvestite. And I think a lot of people, when they see a transvestite, myself included, is that you think that they were gay. You still think that when you see somebody in drag. So, he was kind of, you know, from his letters, he was very casual about it. So it wasn't a big issue to him. And that's why, you know, when he's sitting around, part of the time he's wearing pants and his Angora sweater, it's not like, it's like he said, it just felt good, you know. And that's, again, the thing that I think was important to me, to show the matter-of-fact quality, that he wasn't like real consciously going out of his way to do it, in dress and drag.
Oh, just like in the script.
Colleen Atwood.
It wasn't like Ed Wood was, you know, a jock that became a woman or anything. I didn't, like, try to push that in any way. Which I like a lot with leading men, is I liked Ed Wood's clothes to be very simple. And basically, some of my reference with Ed Wood when he was going to studios trying to take meetings was in, like, a dark suit, white shirt sort of look. And I thought it was a great way to keep him very kind of simple that way. So when he became a woman, it was, you know, more of a moment than have him running around in Hawaiian shirts and, you know, khaki pants, which probably was what a lot of people in L.A. wore in the 50s. But I didn't want to do that with Johnny's character in the movie. I thought it was, you know, a bit distracting, and that it was better to go the other way with Ed Wood, the simple way. My post is so I definitely pushed it that direction. Trust me, you'll be better. Luckily, you know, I mean, Johnny Depp makes all of that very approachable because he works with you on the character, and he's an actor that really is not a vanity-driven person. So he's willing to go out there, and, you know, he borrowed slips in pre-production to get used to wearing women's clothes, and, you know, he got into the character deeply, which helped me with organizing his costumes as a woman. And fortunately, I mean, he's got a great body for to be a woman or a man, you know, so either way, it works on him. It was helpful that it was him. It made my life probably easier than it would have been if I'd had somebody that was overweight or had a leather, you know, other weird issues about themselves. So Johnny was totally free with that, which is really the spirit of Ed Wood. I mean, he was definitely a free-spirited kind of person, and I think that Johnny did an amazing job of sort of bringing that to life in the movie.
Johnny, even disheveled and in drag, has got to look a lot better than most people anyway. Yeah, so it is a somewhat romanticized, no matter how bad he looks. But you know, he just definitely had the right quality for that character. And I really enjoyed working with him on that. And what was amazing, and it's fun to work with people that you've worked with before, especially somebody like him. Because, you know, Edward Scissorhands was a character that didn't speak. And now we're, you know, dealing with a character who won't shut up. And it was kind of, it's great to see an actor go from one thing to something completely different. I can't tell you the energy, you know, there's a great energy to seeing something like that. And, you know, he's just so willing to do anything, Johnny, that way, you know. And in fact, he wants to usually go further than you want him to go. And it's nice for other actors to see, you know. I mean, you know, I could sense between, like, Johnny and Martin, there was a real respect and a real kind of bonding that kind of went with them because they were both good, you know, in a certain level. And so it was exciting to see that. And they kind of actually, you know, like in the film, seemed to kind of get that kind of bond between them.
Great to see you. 8 o'clock on the dot, right on time.
I'm always on time.
Of course you are. Well, we got a big day.
These are two disparate people who join up because they need each other. And then actually there's this affinity that grows. And this, I always thought of it as a male love story. You know, I mean, not a homosexual story, but a male love story. Two guys who really can depend on each other when push gets the shove and stuff. And Johnny and I, just upon meeting, I mean, it was a great kind of...
What do you people do and get back to work?
We just hit it off very quickly. And it was enjoyable to work with Johnny. You know, no two takes are exactly the same, which is what, you know, what I look forward to when it's give and take and moment to moment and you don't quite know what's going to happen next exactly. And that's what, you know, good tennis game's about. You play a better game of tennis when you're playing with a good player.
Mr. Rugosi, I know you're very busy, but can I have your autograph?
Certainly.
This scene here actually gets us in trouble with a lot of Lugosi purists.
Oh, boy.
That we have Landau swear up a storm here.
All over the movie.
Yeah. But it's particularly this scene where he calls Karloff a limey cocksucker.
That's a good line.
It's a fun... Fuck you!
Fuck you!
Karloff does not deserve to smell my shit! That limey cocksucker can rot in hell for all I care!
Well, it's in Nightmare of Ecstasy, there's a man named John Andrews who gives a lot of the interviews, and I think what happens is in a lot of John Andrews interviews, John Andrews swears, and his swearing becomes part of the story. So we read a couple of these things where he would talk about Lugosi going off, and he would say, and Lugosi would say, fuck you, and then, you know, and so we
Are
thought...
Are you allowed to swear on commentary tracks?
So we took that. We actually thought it was funny that Lugosi would just go off, and there's mention of Karloff as this arch nemesis, as this guy who's sort of always compared with, who just, you know, this shadow guy who has such a successful successful career and Lugosi doesn't. So we went with it. There are people like Corey Ackerman and other monster guys.
They hate us for it.
They think, oh, you degraded Lugosi. You have him swear, and so Lugosi never swore like that. And I think they missed a point that this movie is a love letter to Bela Lugosi.
This movie loves Lugosi so much.
He's not swearing to make him seem like he's a coarse, horrible person. He's swearing so you can make him, you feel
he's
his
human.
Pain.
I think of the word fuck as a term of love. I mean, if you say it properly, it's not offensive. And the act itself is wonderful. Anyway, I realize that stuff was funny in this picture. They had to be heartfelt and funny. I just had an affinity. Now, one of the things that bothered his son initially, Bela Jr., who put the movie down before he saw it. Well, you have to know that he was in his teens, I think he was 11, 12, something like that, maybe 13, when his father died. He said, my father didn't use language like that.
Well, nobody's bothered but you.
Probably didn't use it in front of his son. And may not have used it.
Say it a little louder.
But there's nothing wrong with language like that if it's expressive and coming from a place. He doesn't use language like that in front of women. He doesn't, you know. I mean, I tried to dignify him. I really did. I felt this was a love letter to him. It was a love letter to all actors, I felt. I really looked at it as here was a guy who was really talented. He was incredibly, I mean, you couldn't take your eyes off him. And as things went on, his career diminished, and the kinds of roles he played became a caricature of himself, much like John Barrymore did. It was a major disappointment how his career went to, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet he, quite a spiritual man. I wanted you to understand him and have empathy. Not too much sympathy, but empathy. I don't want you to feel sorry for him exactly. I wanted you to understand him. I kept away from self-pity. You know, if a character feels sorry for himself, who gives a damn? You know, I like characters that are always reaching. I like people like that in life. I don't care how rough things are. You can see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel and move towards it. That's what it's about.
That's what Johnny captured in his, like, enthusiasm. I think you just get it. You get his joy of it and his enthusiasm for it. And films have a way of making, you know, taking on the life of their own that way. And I think that the beautiful thing about the Ed Wood family is that it did kind of happen with the actors in the dynamic of the way it kind of was. I mean, Johnny's portrayal as Ed in his upbeat ways, he was charming, and he was something that everybody gravitated towards.
Looks like you got some film.
And Bella was like the star and an emotional sort of strength in there, and that became true. And, you know, you were just sort of mesmerized by his performance. So that did, you know, that added to the mystique and the power of him being central to that group. And I think on some subconscious level, you know, that was another thing that I gravitated towards.
So what's up next for you?
Well, you know, I don't believe in thinking small, so I've got a whole slate of pictures.
You know, some of the original Ed Wood letters in terms of his sort of enthusiasm and the kind of juxtaposition of that. And you know, because there was enough depression, it sort of threw him that we wanted to, that's why we wanted that sort of positive mentality to be the sort of main aspect of it.
Doctor.
But, you know, Johnny has his whole, you know, backlog of sort of inspirations, and I throw out a couple. I mean, I was talking about, you know, ventriloquist dummies, and he was talking about Ronald Reagan. You know, I mean, that's a good thing about certain actors. We can talk on sort of abstract levels and kind of finally, but still understand each other, you know. And he had another inspiration, which I can't remember what it was. I thought it was Ronald Reagan, but I can't remember. There might have been another one, too.
A sterling young actress, Dolores Fuller.
It's difficult because the movie rarely interacts with normal society. Right. I mean, Ed and his gang tend to exist in their little hermetic bubble. And the big joke in the movie is that the, quote, villains or antagonists tend to be Sarah Jessica's character, Dolores Fuller, and the Baptist.
And
these people are being so reasonable. Sarah Jessica's just saying, do you have to parade around in earrings and my angora? And the Baptists are just saying, Mr. Wood, can't we just have continuity? Can't you just have shots cut together? I mean, all of the bad guys in this movie, they're not asking for anything that any rational person wouldn't ask for. But the values of the movie have been so flipped around.
And hopefully we've got the audience so much on Ed's side that the audience is saying these to these people, you know, leave Ed alone. Let him make the movie he wants to make. Let him walk around in a dress, you know?
I mean, look at this. This is like poor Mr. Feldman. He comes across like a bad guy here. He's not doing anything wrong. He's just saying, what the hell are they showing me here? This can't be for real.
I love the performances of the two flunkies in the theater, just because they're clearly waiting for their boss's reaction to sort of, is it okay to laugh?
Oh, God. The clothing, the actual contours of a girl. Most transvestites do not want
to. It's easy to like Johnny Depp, because he's not worried about how he looks. You know, he's concerned with the character. You know, I mean, there's a lot of actors that are much more vain, you know, maybe because they're not as good looking as him, you know, or maybe because they're more insecure about their acting. I'm not sure, but you know, I worked on,
George,
I guess, you know, two movies with Johnny Depp, and he really is very secure as an actor, and that makes it easy for him to work with.
It ain't gonna play in L.A.
Why not?
I think they tried to shoot location work as much as they could, because I think Tim felt that it led to an authenticity, you know, to it that there are certain, I think, probably budgetary reasons why they built some of the interiors. But Tim liked the idea of shooting in as real a place. You know. It's actually shot in downtown L.A. It was a big old wrecked auditorium someplace downtown. And what was hard about this scene is that Bunny is pure white, you know? And so for me to not make him just burn out like an apparition, you know, was fighting his costume. And the people in the foreground, like, you're asked to not, you don't want the actors in the foreground to be too bright. It's a hard balance between having your eye go to the main row there without it seeming too theatrical, you know. This came out really good for me.
Wrestling was a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, you had early television in it. It had a lot of wrestling on it. And Tor Johnson, he was a celebrity. He was big time. When Ed snagged him, that was a coup.
You know, I talked earlier about my father always taking me to the drive-in. When the nights that he didn't take me to the drive-in, I convinced him to go drive quite a distance to take me to see wrestling matches. Actually, this is the introduction of George the Animal Steele, who was an actual wrestler, who you know, sort of was doing the Tor Johnson act. Though, as a professional wrestler, George the Animal Steele is a bit... I don't know if I'd call the character he plays retarded, but there's definitely a simple-mindedness.
Like an animal.
He's just a guy who drools, where Tor never had that persona. It was funny, because Tor is such a strange, strange piece of casting that you couldn't just go to, you know, Dramalog and say, send me, you know, or order the CAA. Oh, bring in five Tor Johnsons. And so literally Tim opened up the casting and said, you know, anyone from around the country who wants to play Tor Johnson, please send me a tape. And we got this whole stack of
terrifying
tapes. Yeah, big fat bald guys, basically, you know. There was one that was particularly scary, because it was a man, like a bald-headed guy, carrying his daughter.
Like handheld, like, high camera, chasing him around his living room.
And she picks him up and he carries her into the basement. And it was like, oh, Lord, this is terrifying.
He's going to murder her. We should call the police.
Yeah. But we went with the most well-known. I mean, people all along were saying, oh, you should get George the Animal Steele.
Again, this is another meeting scene, sort of illustrated how we had a meeting all the characters we had to make up, and we basically would just try to be as iconographic as possible. So you meet Lugosi in a coffin. You meet Tor Johnson in a wrestling ring. You meet Criswell predicting the future.
Right, you meet Vampira on her TV show. So when you second you see these people, you know what they're supposed to be.
Because there is a bit of a third inning Dirty Dozen thing going on here, where Ed is accumulating a cast of wackos to follow him along for the rest of the movie, and we had to use a bit of shorthand just to quickly tell the audience who the heck these people are.
Bella? Bella? Bella, what happened?
The intimate stuff was not really taken from anything, you know, specifically about from Ed or Bella's life. It just, we just felt, you know, I guess we were trying to do it more universal, that this is, you know, if you love somebody who is an addict, you know, this is how you try to take care of them, particularly in an older man. I mean, it was just, we really felt there was this father and son bond that these two guys had. When the few writings that you have about Lugosi from Ed, or transcripts of Ed talking about Lugosi, don't really talk about, you know, the addiction or anything like that. They talk about more about failed projects that the two of them were trying to get off the ground.
Bella, what's in the needle?
Morphine. Blue Demerol Chaser. Eddie, I'm so broke. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Don't worry, Bella. I won't let you down. Mr. Belbin? Ed Wood. Yeah, listen, I haven't been able to get...
This is one of the most memorable scenes. When people,
Johnny's greatest,
yeah,
phone call.
When people come up to me on the street, they usually are using this line.
Well,
you know?
The next one will be better. Hello. Yeah.
First film you ever saw. Well, my next one will be better. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I think we both got a sense from his letter, this sort of upbeat kind of, let's put on a show kind of, you know, Andy Hardy kind of, like, yeah, you know. So, and I think that's where Johnny came up with his, that sort of over-enthusiastic kind of portrayal, you know, which was great, because it was at odds with what was going on. And I think that, for me, that kind of struck a balance, showing you where somebody was at in their own head versus what was really going on, which kind of, for me, made him a very endearing character. Now, this, I think we were, there is a dynamic of showing him probably being a bit more enthusiastic than he probably really was.
Huh? Is he available Friday night? Well, gee, I suppose so. Why?
Greetings, I am the cop.
You see the lights on the top? Like, I want those to overexpose like that, so I gotta set them a certain way and make them flare. It's hard about a shot like this. I gotta balance the TV, the shot like live. It's not a green screen, it's a live video input in there. I shot that really, really low light level because it couldn't, Tim liked that old television, and he couldn't, I could only get it a certain brightness, you know, so I'm basically, that television monitor is dictating the, but that didn't look like a low light level shot, it looked like it was in a TV studio, you know.
This TV sequence is based upon a real event that happened with Red Skelton. Where Lugosi did a gas shot and Skelton started ad-libbing and Lugosi freaked out and didn't know what to do. I don't think it was a completely successful scene in terms of how we wrote it. The concept that Bella is not hearing the cue lines he was expecting to hear is a little abstract as a concept to get across to an audience.
Right. But this was actually true in real life. Bella did not hear that well. And a really funny story, a true story that we didn't work into the film.
House of Wax?
Yeah, was that Bella did a special appearance at the premiere of House of Wax.
Which he's not in.
He's not even in. That's how bad Bella's career is at the point. He was actually showing up at premieres of movies that he wasn't to promote other movies.
Him and a guy in a gorilla suit.
Right. He agreed to be interviewed for this radio guy. But he said, I have to have the questions in advance.
Lando loves this story.
Yeah. So basically the guy gave him these questions, like five questions, and him and Eddie looked at the questions, and basically he memorized what the five questions were. And so the guy went to the interview, and he asked the questions out of order. But Bella gave the answers in order.
Lando does this routine. Yeah. Things. It's like, so, Mr. Lugosi, what do you think of the movie? Thursday!
Just a production note, the audience that you see for the this Red Skelton Variety Hour is actually a shot stolen from the end of the movie.
Okay, Chris Levinson stole the shot.
It's from the premiere Plan 9.
Shot shows up twice.
Yeah, you actually can freeze frame. You can see, I think, a couple of Ed's crew people are like in the front row.
Hey, Gas Squad, you're giving stuff away.
No, that's the whole point of the DVD commentary. Is that those Edwood freaks have gotten this far in the commentary.
This is a great shot. There's just so many elements in it.
Yeah.
Cheer up. Don't lose heart over what happened tonight. I predict your next project will be an outstanding success.
Jeffrey's great. You know, I worked with Jeffrey on Beetlejuice, but somehow, you know, you look at Criswell and you look at Jeffrey, and again, it needed, he's somebody who wasn't as well known as Bela Lugosi, but he was a well-known figure, and so it was, again, I thought important to get somebody who had that look and dynamic, and Jeffrey's got that sort of, and just that look, that certain deadpan look that had that kind of weird sort of mystique of Criswell, you know, and from Ed Wood, and then doing Sleepy Hollow, I'm now obsessed by Jeffrey in wigs, because he's just so hilarious. I guess it's from seeing him in Amadeus or something, but he's something, I just, every time Jeffrey's in a wig, I die with laughter.
Say, Chris, how'd you know
if you went to shoot this film again now? I bet you Tim would be shooting close-ups of the people over there. They would make him do it. You know, it's a new aesthetic, a new modern-day requirement that you shoot close-ups, that you shoot over-the-shoulder shots. Because stuff goes to television. All of a sudden, if they say that, well, where's the close-ups? I can't see it. You know, this or that. So it's just affected. It affects everything. Luckily, it didn't affect, you know, like we weren't under those conditions, you know. The old Brown Derby. What's hard about that was just making the background disappear. Like behind there, there's actually a big building, you know, in real life. Historically, the Brown Derby didn't have a skyscraper behind it. It was its own place. But also it's a little bit aesthetically, but it's also like a little bit of a thing that they throw on you. Well, you'll get rid of that building, right? You know, like we won't see that. You know, but if you're standing there, there's a building behind there. You know, if you went there to visit the set. To actually see the place back there, you have to set your exposures correctly so that it disappears. You know, because they're able to do things now. There's technology now in terms of removing things. That if the movie's already going to go through some digital phase or optical phase, then you know they have some. They already put money in ahead of time for that.
Goodbye.
Well, Eddie, how'd we do?
We didn't make a nickel.
I cannot believe I'm in Hollywood. You know, Daddy didn't want me to move out here.
Uh-huh. Ma'am, your bill comes to $2.20.
Oh. Okay. I hope you don't mind, but all I have is a 50. I just came from my bankers.
That's all right.
This is Martin Landau's daughter, Juliet, who is playing Loretta King, who actually has the strangest backstory of all time, which is that she is allergic to water. That's what they claim, which we don't understand. How can someone be allergic to water? But all the stories say, oh yeah, she couldn't drink water of any kind.
There was a lot of legal contention between Loretta King and the real Dolores Fuller, and even now, 50 years later, they still argue over whether Loretta actually promised Ed the money for the budget or whether it was a misunderstanding or whether Ed gave Dolores' part to Loretta because he thought he was going to get $60,000 from her, or whether she only promised him $300, and we actually had to navigate the lines of dialogue very carefully with the Disney lawyers so we wouldn't have any of these women suing us all these years later. We officially don't take a stand. If you watch the lines very carefully, you know where Larry and I are coming from, but we couldn't actually say it.
For an entire picture,
Well, I met Juliet because she's Martin's daughter, but I didn't hire her for that reason. Though she's got a great strange quality, and that character, I mean, when the guy offers her water and she says, "No, I don't drink water. I'm allergic to liquids." I mean, you believe her, you know? I mean, she's got this weird quality to her, and so she just, you know, again, without having to do anything, just fit right into the Ed Wood family there.
File clerk.
Those sound kind of small.
The biggest sequence that was in our script that did not get shot, and really it was just because we wrote such a friggin' long script, 147 pages, and all those line producers were just begging us to find something to cut just so they could shoot the movie. In the middle of the movie, there was a sequence after Dolores leaves him where he meets this girl and he has an instant rebound marriage. Ed calls up all his buddies and saying, "Come on down to the soundstage, I'm having a party Saturday night," and they show up and he says, "Meet my new bride." And they're like, "What?" And it's just some girl he just picked up named Norma McCarty. They get married, and then there's this wacky sequence where they go off on the honeymoon, and she's very prim and proper Midwestern girl, and he takes off his wedding tux underneath he's got on a brassiere, and she screams, and the marriage ends. And it's so so depressing for him that he can be rejected in that way, and it hurts him so much. And then he ends up later on meeting the Patricia Arquette character, Kathy.
I really like the sequence quite a bit, but it seemed to be easy to cut out. It was a thing where you could literally just lift that little, like, 7-page sequence, and it didn't really affect anything on either side. Ed's rejection made it a little bit, you know, deeper. You felt a little bit deeper for his plight, but it worked anyway. It worked without the sequence, and I think that's why it got lifted.
I mean, we're talking about how hard it is to make good movies. Movies are really random, and stuff gets shot, doesn't get shot, actors get cast, people don't get cast, just for completely erratic reasons. So something like Ed's marriage being taken out of the movie, it was taken out because, could be because me and Larry are lazy, and the line producer was begging us to find 5 pages to pull out of the movie, and it was a 5-page lift. And in a screenplay, a lift means you can just pull out those 5 pages and the rest of the movie will make sense, and you don't have to do any other typing. And we sort of said, well, the movie sort of works without the wedding. We're like, "Tim, what do you think?" He says, "Well, I like it, but I guess it's a clean lift." We're like, "All right, cool." Then we could, like, walk right over to the line producer and say, "All right, we cut out 5 pages.
I mean, the thing about
lunch now."
Right. The thing about lifts, though, is that if it can be done, often it is done. Just because, like, even if they would have shot that sequence, there's a good chance it would have wound up on the cutting room floor because you could snip the tail, you know, snip the beginning and snip the end and have the same film. If you can kind of, it's a good test. If you can do that to a scene in your movie, then, you know, maybe the scene doesn't really belong.
Well, that's the weird thing with making movies and trying to have them turn out coherent is stuff ends up in and out of the movie for just such weird reasons. It can just be that, oh, it rained that one day, and so they went over schedule in that location, and so the stuff that we're supposed to shoot on Monday ended up being shot on Tuesday, and the scene that was supposed to be shot on Wednesday, you can't shoot now. So, scene we're shooting on Wednesday, we're not going to shoot. And suddenly that scene was supposed to, like, hold the continuity together, doesn't get shot. And it's not like anyone has a bad agenda. It just happens, and stuff like that happened a lot to Ed Wood, which is why his movies make no sense.
Perfect. Print it. Let's move on.
Don't you want to do another take, Ed? Looks like Big Baldy had a little trouble getting through the door.
No, it's fine. It's real. You know, in actuality, Lobo would have to struggle with that problem every day. All right, people, let's get ready. Actors!
Johnny's great with his megaphone.
Yeah, this was actually a true thing about Ed Wood, is that Ed Wood basically liked to pretend he was a movie director. You know, even when he was directing movies, but it was sort of like
he's seen pictures of C.B. DeMille. Right. You know,
he reminds me of what Jethro does in the Beverly Hillbillies when he pretends to be a movie director. He sort of you know, takes, you know, he speaks constantly in the megaphone. You know, he wears little stirrups.
He's like an 8-year-old boy who wants to be a movie director. He's seen a cartoon of what a director looks like.
All right,
Johnny really liked the optimistic part of Ed. And Johnny said to us that he actually based his performance on a combination of three things. It was Casey Kasem, Ronald Reagan, and the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. And if you watch the movie with in this performance with those three things in mind, you'll just see it. You'll just see he's doing that head shaking thing that Reagan does all the time. Well, gee, mommy, you know. And then it is the Tin Man around Reagan and the voice of Casey Kasem.
I mean, it's fun watching Johnny in these movie making scenes because we're really going for something with Ed where Ed wasn't necessarily concerned with the final product.
No.
It wasn't that important in whether he made a good movie. He just wanted to make a movie. He just liked the idea of being on a set, and there's a camera, and you got a megaphone, and you can yell, action, and you can say, cut. Yeah. And so, you know, this running gag we do where he does one take, and it's never any good, and he says, perfect, moving on. It's like, he just got to experience it. He just got to experience the joy of saying action and watching the actor say the lines, and that's enough for him.
And now I need the other 60,000.
What other 60,000?
The other 60,000 you said you'd give to me.
You misunderstood, Eddie. I gave you everything I have in the world. $300.
Here we go again.
Let me tell you, you can't lose. It's scary. And if you don't like that, it's romantic.
This here on the left, we have the real Greg Wolcott. Sort of the older southern gentleman here
right
on the
there.
Left saying, let's get the hell out of here. That's the real star of Plan 9 from Outer Space. The young pilot.
Right.
This is his cameo in the movie.
Right. He's got an interesting story in the sense that he actually had a regular Hollywood career. He shows up in movies like Prime Cut and Norma Rae, and he worked in Hollywood for years, and he was always terribly embarrassed of the fact that he's in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
He's only in it because he was in the choir of the Baptist Church of Beverly Hills, and the guy behind the church was bankrolling the movie, and he did it as a favor, and it's haunted him ever since.
So he was never a part of Ed Wood's posse, and so he always really looked down on these movies, and he left them off his resume, and it just is completely fascinating to him that the last, like, 20 years of his life have been spent getting a phone call three times a day from someone somewhere like, tell me about Ed Wood.
I mean, he shot 4 days on it 50 years ago. That's all anyone wants to talk about.
Right. And all the people in Ed's entourage, you have people who only exist because of Ed Wood, sort of don't like Wolcott because Wolcott tends to always, oh, God, I'm embarrassed by those pictures.
He dismisses it.
He dismisses them. He's too good for them. And so there's a bit of this tension between Wolcott and the other Woodites.
He's very good-natured about
it. I think Greg Wolcott's a great guy.
Would you like to come over and just say howdy to some of the backers?
Look, I'm with some friends and we're about to eat.
Please, it would just take 1 second. Come on over and meet the backers. There is a really nice dentist from Oxnard.
Look, buddy, I've...
Vampire was showing on television the kind of movies Ed Wood liked to watch. So Ed would watch these movies and call her up on the phone, and he did pursue her for many, many years, and she did think that she was much too big for Ed Wood.
I'm getting a bad feeling about this. Let's get out of here.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you, folks, for coming tonight. We better go.
And then Dr. Voronoff falls into the pit, and his own octopus attacks and eats him. The end.
That's Ron Howard's dad, by the way.
That's Rance Howard.
There's a lot of strange nepotism kind of people in the movie. You've got Ron Howard's dad. You've got Martin Landau's daughter. You've got
John Cusack's brother.
Now we're looking for a complete...
Yeah, Ron Howard's dad.
Son, you're too vague.
You know, I remember seeing him when I used to play, you know, sports as a child in Burbank, you know, playing against Ron Howard's team, you know, the Howard gang. But I didn't really meet him until this, but he, you know, I've actually worked with him a couple of times and seen him in stuff, and he's just a good, you know, he's got that great deadpan thing, you know, he was like one of those kind of scary guys. Most people that have money seem to be kind of scary, you know, it's like, and he had that good kind of like,
yes,
it's a kind of guy that has money, but you'd rather not ask him for it because there's going to be trouble, and, you know, he captured that quite well.
Number two, I got a son, a little slow, but a good boy. And something tells me he'd make a hell of a leading man.
That's true story.
Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
That's true story. That old man McCoy had a son who wanted to be an actor named Tony McCoy, and old man McCoy was a meat man with a bunch of meat money. maybe of anything in this movie, that scene is as verbatim to the truth as you can get.
But the fact that the stuff, it comes back to when Scott and I introduce characters, we introduce them as who they are. So if a guy is a guy who owns meat packing factories, my God, you're going to meet him in the meat packing factory, and you're going to see big slabs of meat, and it's the same way. If you're introducing a Swedish wrestler, you're going to meet him in the ring, and he's a Swedish wrestler. If a guy's a sidekick,
it's a big cast.
Yeah.
So you want people to be able to keep track of all these characters.
So you instantly say, oh yeah, that's the meat guy, that's the wrestler guy, that's, you know, and whatever. This stuff is funny. You know, why not take advantage of the goodies that real life is giving you?
I'm Loretta King. Oh, here, take the chair. No, don't be silly. Let Harry finish. You still need some more work. No, I'm finished. All I needed was a touch-up. That mole still shows.
Ladies, you both look fine. Why don't we talk about the scene? Okay, Janet Lawton has just discovered...
I thought Sarah was great. Here's a character that's not a known character.
Eddie, what...
And... You know, when you really look at the overall Ed Wood biography, if there is such a definitive thing, which I don't think there is, I realized early on, which again was a freedom, it's like there's no way to really identify and really say what is 100% accurate or not. And so I didn't, we never really felt really, really bound by that. And so I think it was more, you know, you needed one character to kind of call it as it was by at that point. And, you know, she did do that. And while also, you know, serving her purpose in the Ed Wood mythology. I mean, that little acting scene she does with Juliet Landau, you know, is great, you know, that little the little secretary scene.
I mean, this movie really is all about tone. It really captures an odd feeling of drama and comedy, and I think Tim nailed it right off the bat. We were so conscious of not making fun of Ed that...
Not making fun of anybody.
Yeah, so we really pushed the movie into a very loving look at these people, and so that's what gives it this nice... warm feeling this whole movie has that's really quite strange. I mean, I think it's about, you know, making horror movies and transvestites, but there's a real warmness to it all, where there's an affection for these people. And it's just because I think we really just did not want to make fun of them, and they had been made fun of so much in the past that we went out of our way to, whenever possible, to give them human moments.
Let's try to give them some dignity.
Yeah.
There it is. Paul, go and hook it.
Right.
It's beautiful.
You sure this is going to work?
This is one of those scenes that, you know, when you start studying real life stories, and everyone tells you the octopus story. Oh, that great octopus story. When we broke into Republic Studios and stole an octopus. And at the end of the day, it's really not much of a story, but you hear it so many times that it seems important.
Right. Like, actually, one of our friends, when he read the script first, he read it before anyone else, Dan Waters, who was a screenwriter, wrote Batman Returns for Tim. His comment to us was like, you guys act like these are like great classic stories. All that time we stole the octopus. Like, nobody knows this, and no one cares, but you guys are treating it like if it's, you know, these are significant acts.
Lights! Now, Janet, I want you staying...
That's one of my favorites to shoot, was the octopus scene, yeah. It was just something about being out in a location in Griffith Park, somewhere supposedly near where they did it, being at night, with that group, you know, that weird family of people, and... You know, I find it to be a very funny scene, a very haunting scene. You know, it's basically kind of a death scene, but most of Bella's scenes are death scenes. And very touching, and sort of with regret and humor and sort of foreboding. And there's just something about the timing of it, the way the actors were doing it, all that. I enjoyed running up and down the hill. You know, because again, it was a scene that kind of mirrored what, you know, making the movie, you know, run up to see Bella, run down to see if the octopus was, the lake was filling up, you know, running over to Stefan, are we ready to shoot, you know, it was, you know, kind of paralleling the scene, and that gave it an extra energy that was appealing.
Hey, this is fantastic. Oh, where's the octopus motor?
I knew that for the night scene at Griffith Park, I needed the flashlights and I needed the headlights.
blame
mostly it was a financial battle, you know, like I knew I wanted to do it, and like production's resisting, they don't want to buy the batteries, you know, and I actually had some of the batteries, I just need more, you know, they don't want to put the bigger shocks, because they were actually going practical cars that were driven. I had them made so you could actually drive the cars down the streets, but they don't want to pay the money to beef up the suspension on these old cars, you know. And that's one of the major fights I had, you know. They're telling you that no, you can't do it that way. It's not worth it to us, you know. And it finally came together. And I finally gave up. I got the batteries. I got the bulbs. And it's worth fighting for because it came out this way. But if you didn't have those lights in those cars up on top, if you didn't have the flashlights, it wouldn't look this way. It would look different, you know. So it's interesting to me that it actually, I don't know, maybe that carries over into other things of painting and stuff. If you use a certain watercolor, a certain pencil, or this kind of stuff, it comes out that way. But this very much came out the way it did because of the instruments.
So when you get in there and fight with him, shake his legs around. Looks like he's killing you. Okay.
You know I turned down Frankenstein.
What?
And a little bit of Martin's confession about Frankenstein, you know. I thought that was very, again, it's very economical, but it sort of shows you that aspect of his character and the sort of regret that perhaps maybe... I think that's the worst thing, you know, when people like that, when they have a sense of regret, it kind of sets you on a course of unhappiness, really, you know? I mean, rather than going, oh, well, I'll let that one go away and kind of moving on, some people get haunted by that sense of regret and then they never really recover from it.
As we were researching the movie, we started compiling lists and lists of just wacky characteristics and attributes of all the people, and so we started calling these our fun fact sheets. So you look at Criswell's fun fact sheet and it would say, bought a Cadillac from Mae West for $1. And then we were just sort of looking for a little more content to the scene, and we were going down our list of fun facts, and we saw that Lugosi had turned down the part of Frankenstein, and you know, which ties into his whole rivalry with Boris Karloff, who then subsequently took the part and became a bigger star.
Right. It was just a thing on our sheet, and we actually tried to work it in like several times in the movie earlier, but
we
never found a place
to put it here. And then suddenly it just seemed like inspiration that, wait a minute, he's about to step his foot into this freezing cold water at 3 a.m. He says, you know, I could have been Frankenstein. And, you know, basically saying, you know, my whole life could have been different, and I wouldn't be standing here right now with you clowns at 4 a.m, which is the subtext. It suddenly became, you know, one of our best scenes in the movie, and it just came out of us saying, all right, what can Lugosi talk about? Hey, wait a minute.
Bella? I want to thank you again for last night.
It's fine, baby. All in the line of duty.
No, I want you to know how much I appreciate all you've done for me. A great man like yourself shouldn't have to be wandering through the muck at 4 a.m.,
The script is sort of oddly laid out because, you know, you have this emotional sort of bonding with Ed and Bella, and then, you know,
all the sacrifices you
made. Two-thirds of the way through the film, he dies, but the film goes on, and it, you know, but it goes on in his spirit, in his sort of memory. It's sort of the whole, you know, that was always interesting about the whole Plan 9 from Outer Space, is that it went on well after he left us. So that's kind of part of the structure of the movie and of that part of the story.
All right, kids. Let's knock them dead.
My dear Professor Strausky, 20 years ago, I was banned from my homeland. I was classed as a madman, a charlatan.
Edward was very, very proud of that script, I mean, of that little speech. He wrote it for Bella because Bella had experienced similar things about wanting to return to his homeland.
He talks about wanting to go back to Hungary, but being afraid they might throw him in the gulag. So Ed writes a speech for him about home, I have no home.
And also, you can also look at it as perhaps, you know, Lugosi talking about Hollywood, in a sense, that, you know, that he has no home, that he's got no place to exist. He's not welcome really in the studios. He's not really, doesn't really fit in with Ed and his gang either. He is just a person who doesn't really belong anywhere. He's a monster.
I have no home. Hunted. Despised. Living like an animal. The jungle is my home.
Lugosi thought of himself as a leading man. He was in Budapest, a member of the National Theater. He would sit with Molnar, who wrote Lilium, which he played originally. He played Hamlet. He saw himself as a romantic leading man. Dracula, when it was first done in 1927 on Broadway, was an enormous success, and he was considered a very romantic character. The Dracula legend wasn't that well known. Nosferatu had been made a silent film, but women were literally fainting watching this man in that role. I think they were orgasmic, literally. So they went to the theater a lot in those days. So and he wasn't supposed to do the movie. Lon Chaney was supposed to do the movie, and Lon Chaney died suddenly. And you know, I can hear the conversation. Hey, why don't we get the guy who did it in New York? Yeah, I mean, he was born in Transylvania, so it was a perfect marriage. And after that, he didn't want to be relegated to that. He was offered the monster in Frankenstein, as the picture indicates, and passed on it. He thought it was a romantic, and he saw himself really as a leading man, and his accent got in his way. Now, the English in Hollywood at that time, there was a big British colony, and you had Basil Rathbone and Ronald Coleman. So Karloff was credibly accepted, you know. I mean, after all, he spoke very well, and his career sort of usurped Lugosi's. The accent relegated him to playing certain kinds of roles.
This scene here features the organ work of Korla Pandit. Korla was a contemporary of Ed's at the time. He had his own television show, sort of like an Indian Liberace. And he was a bit of a Los Angeles celebrity at the time, and basically experienced a little bit of a resurgence at the time we were shooting this movie. There was a magazine called Cult Movies that would always have an article about Ed Wood, an article about Lugosi, and for some reason also an article about Korla Pandit. And so
my friend Brian was friends with this guy Joey Cheesy doing shows with Korla at Kelbo's Polynesian Restaurant, and so they had somebody who had his phone number. So we were able to track down Korla, and it was a nice little bit of PR for him.
Right.
Oh, that's a disgusting shot.
Ed really did lose his pearlies in the war. He was battling the Japanese, and someone put the butt of a rifle into his face.
Yeah, this is probably the only time he's confronted about the quality of his work. She's not a bad lady.
I wouldn't say it's the only place, because there's many times my next one will be better. There's a lot of times where people sort of throw it at him. It's the only time where he sort of seems to be affected by it a little bit. He sort of, in a sense, realizes that he's sort of depressed now. Strange enough, there were a lot more moments like this in the script where Ed sort of had self-doubt and questioned whether what he was doing was right. I think Johnny and Tim grew to love Ed so much that they sort of made them feel uncomfortable to give Ed those moments.
Yeah, they almost made them feel like they were hitting him below the belt.
Right.
I mean, I'd say a high percentage of the deleted scenes involve Ed in low points. If you sit down and you watch all the deleted scenes back to back, you might get depressed.
Yeah. The reasoning is, I think, probably one, pacing, but two, that I think they just fell in love with Ed, and they didn't want to see Ed be down. It's happened to us in a number of the biographies, is that the filmmakers or the actors just love the character so much that the parts of their character that you sort of want to turn away from, they don't want to embrace. They just want to love this guy.
You'd like to go out sometime.
I would say that it's generally okay. Where the movie gets hurt by it is that there's a section in the film where it kind of becomes just backers' parties. It's Ed raising money You know, and that was a problem with the script and with the film, is that there's a section where just like there's a little too much fundraising going on, and I think that we inserted a couple scenes in there where Ed was sort of, you know, spinning out of control, and then they wound up being deleted. It's basically based on a true story. There, Ed went to Bella once, and Bella wanted to commit suicide, and tried to talk them into doing a, basically doing a double suicide. There was also we took a, this is also a print the legend thing, where the Medvids had misinterpreted a drug that Bella had been drinking, and actually printed that he drank formaldehyde. And it just becomes one of those things that shows up in so many things that we wound up actually having Bella say he was drinking formaldehyde, even though I don't think the real Bela Lugosi ever did. Yeah, we use it as a way of, like, you know, both guys sort of pushing each other a little bit, and Bella, you can interpret it as Bella realizing that he's a dead man already, and so he might as well just embalm him right now.
He's a relic. He's a bit of a dinosaur at that time. The fact that he never drove was an interesting thing as well. I mean, here's a guy who lives in a town and barely can... And particularly in those days where things were... There were big spaces between Brentwood and Westwood and Beverly Hills. I mean, you know, Culver City was all way the hell out there. And Malibu was a million miles away.
I'm on your side.
When he was wealthy, he could be driven. And that's why, towards the end, very end of his life, he lived off of Hollywood Boulevard near a liquor store.
What are you drinking?
We don't have that in the movie. We have the little house. No, if you see the movie, we duplicated the house in a sense. The door's in a slightly different place. You've seen the original film, right, where he picks the flower? Well... That was not his house. That was the wrestler's house. And we made it his house. There were a couple of licenses, you know. As a matter of fact, I did visit all of... I'm not sure they're all, but... what I expect to be true, all of the houses that Lugosi lived in. And I saw the decline, and I saw the...
Oh, my goodness.
Sadness of that.
You look like that Dracula guy.
My name is Bela Lugosi. I wish to commit myself.
Most people just think of Bela as Dracula. They don't really know about his struggle with addiction, and maybe they do now because of this film, particularly at the time they didn't. But Bela is probably the first celebrity to use... going into rehab as kind of a career press release situation, where he literally tried to get people the right stories about him because he was going through rehabilitation.
Their clippings. So he treated it as a career move.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm on the front page.
Yeah. In fact, I think that's what the following scene is, that he invited all this press over to.
We loved this concept that he was the celebrity to invent rehab, and we had a line about that, but it made Martin very uncomfortable. The only time he ever tried changing anything we ever wrote was he said the word rehab wasn't an expression in the 50s. And we're like, well, what are you going to say? First celebrity ever checking a rehabilitation? That doesn't sound like anything. So we had this little jovial argument about it, and then at the end of the day, he sort of realized he had to say some version of the line, so he said, first celebrity ever checking a rehab... Then he started coughing.
Right.
He wouldn't have to finish the word.
Right. He had the cough instead of just using the slang.
What are you? An Angora wholesaler?
No. No. I'm in pictures.
If there's one meet that's just completely made up and has no basis in anything, it is this scene where he meets Kathy, where we just... completely lied and just said that she's got a father staying in the same hospital, and she's knitting him booties because my grandmother always used to knit us booties, and it's just us taking a bunch of nonsense and crafting a scene around it, but it gave her a nice introduction, and it sort of gave her an empathy for Ed,
right,
meeting him under the same circumstances. I remember joking with Kathy. She's like, where did you read that? I wasn't in that hospital. I wasn't knitting booties. I don't even know how to knit. I was like, well, sorry, Kathy.
Right. But basically, it came at a low moment for Ed, where he's taking care of his friend Bella, and then this woman comes in. And then they're very, very soft scenes. They're the softest scenes in the movie, where it's just sort of really gentle, and they're just talking about things, and it allows her to her entrance to be one of this mellow understanding. And so when she offers, you know, when she knits something for Bella, you know, you can tell in Ed's eyes that, oh my God, this is the woman for me. This is the woman who, you know, who has kindness in her soul.
Andy, why did you chase them?
Lugosi was the first one who publicly went into a rehabilitation place and publicly announced it. There's a shot that I use as a guide for that. And if you look at that picture, he's in a hospital, and that press is crowded around him, and he looks shriveled and small. And I did that. I looked teeny. I wanted to look as if all the juice had oozed out of him. He didn't live too long after that, you know. He became clean. But sometimes that happens when you become dependent on something and your body gets used to it. I think sometimes, you know, alcoholics who stop drinking sometimes have heart attacks. People who stop smoking quickly sometimes get sick.
No, I'm fine. How's your father?
We shot a lot of this movie sort of in real Ed Wood locations, the same places where he would have hung out, and a lot of the movie was right off of Hollywood Boulevard. And so one day we're shooting the sequence on Hollywood Boulevard where Ed runs into Musa and Franks, and they're like prepping the scene, and suddenly this PA comes running up to me saying, hey, Scott, there's this lady over there who said she's married to Ed Wood. I'm saying, you know, and then she just walked away. I go, what? So I ran after her, I chased her, and I'm like, Kathy, wait! I grabbed her, I'm like, come to the set. And she's like, oh, I don't want to bother anyone, that's okay. I'm like, come, Kathy, for God's sake, here, let me carry your stuff. So I walk her to the set, and she says, well, I would love to meet Johnny Depp. Is Johnny Depp here today? I'm like, oh, yeah, of course you can meet him. Come on. Well, what are you doing? Oh, we're shooting a scene. She says, I'm so excited. What is he doing here? And then I suddenly realized, oh, my God. And then I remembered that we were about to shoot the scene where he runs into Musa and Franks, and he's coming off a set of Plan 9 in drag, but his makeup is, like, wiped all over. His lipstick is, like, smudged on his cheeks. His wig is askew. I mean, he looks like a drag queen who's been beat up in a back alley. And then she's like on her toes, like hopping up and down outside the trailer, like, when's Johnny coming out? And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a disaster. This is like her introduction to our movie, seeing this image. But finally, she's like, okay. And the door opens, and Johnny steps out. Just, he couldn't have looked worse at this moment. And she looks up into his eyes and says, he looks just like my Eddie.
Just like Ed. That put everyone at ease. And she gave Johnny Ed Wood's wallet. And in it was a little skinny address book with a lot of the names who are in this movie. It has Lugosi's name, number, you know, the old numbers with, you know, H.O. Hollywood something, something, you know, and before it became all numerical.
Kathy?
The thing that I got from meeting Kathy Wood and hearing her voice was just this almost a sweetness, a painful, sad sweetness, you know, and somebody who really did seem like she supported him. And that's kind of a tough thing to do, and I thought that Patricia did a very good job. I mean, it's a quick moment, but one of my favorite moments is when they get, you know, stranded in the spook house. And he sort of tells his story, and then she just sort of takes a beat and then just sort of says, okay. And there's a quality in her voice which almost makes me cry every time. And it's just, that to me was the essence of what she did, just being very simple and sweet and accepting. And that's something that I find very difficult to do, and I really thought that she nailed that part of it.
Okay. thought that Mr. Lugosi was insured through his union.
Isn't he?
I got together with Colleen and discussed the costumes. And one of the things I said was this takes place in the 50s, but he wasn't doing very well, and therefore he couldn't update his wardrobe. When he had money was in the 30s and 40s, and these clothes should look like that. He should look out of date.
It was all about like the one suit and the little cape and the hat, and it was very simple, and once you got it right, it was like a good thing to stick to. It's pretty much in the same thing the whole movie, as a lot of old people are, you know, they don't tend to change clothes as much as, you know, as people do nowadays.
The test came back fine. Come on, let's get up.
He was in a state of poverty, but he had a lot of dignity. So the combination was, you know, to go with the sort of European gentleman dignity side of who that man was, and not having be like a bum or something like that. That didn't make sense, and it certainly was something that, you know, it's a sort of cliche to make him too much of a bum when he's, you know, just because he doesn't have money and stuff, he still has his style and his class that he always had.
This is so exciting. Another production.
Isn't it?
So, Eddie, shouldn't we have a sound crew?
No.
This sequence is a real example of us sort of moving things around in real life chronology to sort of make a dramatic point. In real life, Ed was always shooting pieces of film and trying to raise money off them. And in real life, he went and shot some promo footage of Lugosi and was trying to hustle people with it. And we sort of thought it would be more touching to have Ed shooting this piece of film just to make Lugosi happy. Just for Bella to have the experience of starring in one more movie, even though if you look around, there's no crew, there is no movie. It's just Ed in a roll of film.
That is great.
And so we sort of, when we order the scenes, we put the scene right after they check out of the hospital, just so it would have that impact.
Listen, I was calling to see if you'd like to attend the world premiere of my new movie, Bride of the Monster.
Didn't you just make one called Bride of the Atom?
Yes, it's the same film, but the distributor wanted a punchier title. Come on, it's going to be a big event. Bellator and Chris are coming. You'll have fun.
I can't see. These contact lenses are hurting.
Eyes are killing me.
Don't worry, we're almost there.
Hi. Right in there.
We did try to stay as close to the truth as possible. And at one point we looked at each other and we said, you know, wouldn't it be a better third act if Glenn or Glenda is the third act of the movie as opposed to Plan 9 from Outer Space? I mean, we just said this as an emotional growth, if it's about this guy who makes these two monster movies and they don't really work out, and he makes a decision, you know what, I've got to tell my own story. I've got to tell the story from my heart. He goes off and makes this personal vision. We thought that would make probably a better dramatic arc for the film, but we felt we couldn't play with the facts that much, and so we decided to keep Glenn or Glenda as the first film that he made.
Yeah, I mean, we really obsessed over trying to stick the facts as much as possible. I mean, yeah, some things got omitted and some people got omitted, but in terms of what you see on screen, we really tried to be truthful. I was trying to play it the last whenever possible. So, then the dilemma became, well, if Ed Wood's almost most genre-bound movie, you know, Planet from Outer Space, is the third act, how do you make it emotionally satisfying? We sort of had this whole idea of him trying to continue his life and his work without Lugosi, and then sort of him having this epiphany that this will be the movie he's remembered for, and you sort of get this ridiculous, absurd ending where he has transcended, and he knows he's made his mark. Just the postmodern joke is he doesn't know he's made it for the wrong reason.
That was a premiere.
What's interesting about that is I called it the limo. I got a track on the ground. It's not a steady cam shot. It's actually a dolly shot. But I got a track that I bent the track. It's a really wide one. I made it as like welded together so that the actors don't have to walk on a track. But I actually had the track bent on a curve. I had a really talented grip, Barry Lopez, who measured it out. He sent it to a pipe bending place. So I had this curve where it ends up into this theatrical thing with the proscenium. And the reason I did that was I didn't want it to feel like a Steadicam shot. I wanted it to be more like a classic thing. And like technically, I had never seen that done before. I did it with the grips. Because I had these two pieces of pipe, and they had no... They usually, when they lay them down, they usually have some cross members that hold them. But these two pipes floated, and they just changed their shape on a sync dialogue scene. They floated. At first, the guy got there, was a little bit of a problem. They started to squeak, you know? You know, but they got him to keep quiet by spraying them.
The jungle is my home. But I shall show them...
Bella's final speech, you know. He wanted to do a little bit of a dramatic move. It's obviously a move that Ed Wood wouldn't have done. I remember talking with Stefan, the cameraman, and we would just try to find the right balance of it. So it wasn't too showy. We didn't want to, if we moved the camera, we didn't want to make it too showy, because that would have just sort of brought it ahead to something and made it another comment that it didn't need to make. So, you know, I probably moved the camera a little bit less, but still, you know, making it a movie and doing a little bit of it. But it was always a weird balance of it. I mean, again, nothing so overly jolting and modern and dramatic as to just, it's more of an emotional underpinning as opposed to anything too quick and strong.
Wood Productions.
We've kind of been seeing Bella die so many times that it just, you know, we start him in a coffin and we end him in a coffin. So we felt like it wasn't over-sentimental, it wasn't over-dramatized. It's like real death, you know, when somebody's ill or something, you know, they're still there and then just one day they're gone. And that to me was more real, you know. We're not sitting there watching Bella die or Ed's not there, you know, which he wasn't. So we just felt like it was both realistic in that sense, which didn't make it over sentimental, but it, you know, felt the funeral was very, you know, had the right sentimental quality to it. To see him sort of in his, seeing Dracula being buried one final time, you know, I thought was very powerful. And, you know, picking that kind of location where you, you know, sort of Baldwin Hills kind of with the oil tanker, you know, just had a weird kind of real quality to it that was important in sort of not making it over sentimental as well.
The movie's called Ed Wood, but it almost works as a biopic of Lugosi too, because, I mean, he is up there with, you know, Bogart and Monroe as icons, but he really only starred in two or three major studio movies. I mean, his career hit the skids so fast after Dracula. It's really bizarre. Where he, you know, ended up making movies for these low-budget companies, you know, like, you know, Monogram and PRC, and just as low-end as they could come. And for some reason, Universal just didn't want to exploit him in the role of Dracula. I mean, he only played Dracula twice in his life on screen. He played it in Dracula, and he played it in Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein, oddly enough. And other than that, he was really slumming in third and fourth build supporting parts or working for, you know, Skid Row Studios. And so, you know, we felt that it was such a great story, you know, how someone so famous and talented can just kind of be thrown away, and then he's just this old man wondering what the hell happened.
Picture business. Yeah.
Also, sort of on the Lugosi front, when we started working on this treatment and we had this idea that Tim Burton might want to direct it, we really started to focus on this relationship between the two men because it reminded us a lot of Tim's relationship with Vincent Price. I mean, and, you know, in terms of, you know, you make movies about what you know, Tim had, you know, been obsessed with Vincent Price as a little boy and gotten to meet him, you know, real late in the actor's life and gotten to work with him. And it was such a thrill for Tim. And I mean, I can't, you know, overstress the parallels, but, you know, Ed had loved Dracula as a little boy, and then he got to meet Lugosi at the end of his life and got to give him work when nobody else would give him work, and it meant so much to Ed. And Tim's relationship with Vincent Price meant so much to him. And so we sort of knew that Tim would appreciate this and use it as a good emotional core for the movie.
Right, if I think if there is a universal element to this movie, if you take the Hollywood stuff out of it, I think it is a movie about what happens when you meet your hero. What happens when you meet that guy that you worshipped when you were a kid, and then all of a sudden you become friends with your hero. I think that's sort of what this movie winds up being about.
Yes. You know, in my dealings with Vincent, I never heard him say anything bad about anybody, which was amazing to me. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why I liked him so much, and he was such a positive influence on me. He's like, here you've met somebody who's been through all this stuff, and he's still interested in things, still positive, still seems like he loves it, enjoys it. Whether he's doing a play, a movie, or a shrunken head apple kit, you know, commercial, you know, it's like, and I found that very amazing, you know, and it's something I hope to, you know, retain. It's something I actually have more of a problem with even at my stage, you know, to keep that kind of positive thing. So he was actually more like Ed Wood than he was Bell in that way, probably. I think it's like a survival technique. I mean, I think you either become a complete jerk or you maintain a certain joy of what you're doing and acceptance of what you're doing. It's a mixture of acceptance. Because with that, you have the, everything is interesting, you know, and so I always felt like, wow, that's a really great way to be if you can be that way.
This is the ultimate Ed Wood movie. No compromises.
Oh, Mike. Eddie, look at this.
Yeah.
Poor girl's out of a job.
I brought the script. You'll be portraying the ghoul's wife.
I met Vampira, and then I know Lisa had lunch with her, and I think she showed her like her underwear collection and things like that. I don't know. It sounded like an interesting lunch, but I didn't. You know, I met her and got some information, but I realized that the best way to deal with all of the people was because again, everybody as time has gone on has sort of dug into their perspective of what way things were. And since, again, that's not really what the film was about, because then you'd have to just do the Vampira story, or you'd have to do the Paul Marco story, you know, or you'd have to do the Conrad Brooks story, because each one would tell it in a completely different way. So, again, you know, Rashomon Revisited, we couldn't do... So, I realized it was more important to just get a vibe of it and then kind of leave it, because, you know, I just felt like, you know, overall, I was trying to be respectful of all the people, because I liked them all. I mean, there's not a character in there that I don't feel for on some level and feel, like, close to, you know, to some degree. So, you know, I always felt like we were trying to be, you know, if not necessarily 100% accurate, at least kind of... close-ish in a way, in terms of the feel of it.
Have your face with this.
No, now I can see it.
I want to suck your blood. I want to suck your blood.
Let's hear you call Boris Karloff a cocksucker. We want these Baptists to like us. Please.
Brothers and sisters, we reach now in the service a joyous point, because we are going to bear witness to the baptism of our new members.
Why couldn't
Well, that's the great thing. I mean, to see this group, which you basically think of at night, dark clothing, black. I mean, it was a great, you know, to be out in the day in this sort of a Southern California poolside, you know, white on white, and then, you know, Bill Murray with his white skin, all these white-skinned characters. They look like sort of weird angels, you know, like Ed's angels, you know. It was... You know, one of my favorite shots was, you know, when you're going up in the pews and then you come up on them and then out outside. And, like, especially Bill, he's got that glowing quality. It's so amazing. But, I mean, that was supposedly true, that whole baptism thing and the pool and all of that. So that seems to have a pretty good consensus that some form or another happened. Anything to get money.
How do you get all your friends to get baptized? Just so you can make a monster movie.
It's not a monster movie. It's a supernatural thriller.
Jesus, brother. I can't believe that. Vampire, you know... In this world of lack of success, she was more successful than, you know, than any of them. So sort of seemed to kind of resist it. And you kind of got the sense that she was resisting it. But being an outcast herself, you know, the outcast club, you do find each other, you know, whether you want to or not. You know, there is a reason that all of these people in some form or another were... linked to each other, you know, and I do believe that, whether they like it or not, you know, there's something there that
what are you talking
is
about?
Real and meaningful and karmic and fate to some degree.
Yes,
and you knew it from watching Plan 9. You'd see this group of people and they were linked somehow. You know, you didn't know, you know, it's like great casting, you know, but on a different level, you know.
All right. And action!
What's funny about Paul and Connie is that in this one film, they're both police officers, and they both have made a lifetime obsession talking to fan magazines and being a part of the Edwood entourage. But the way I understand it is that, in my opinion, I'm not sure the two of them actually get along that well. So they're rarely even at the same, you know, sci-fi conventions or anything like this. But in terms of the script, we just made them kind of Paul and Connie. These two guys always follow Ed around. And so they, one of the funny things about the movie is that it sort of cemented these guys as partners, even though they were never partners, and I don't think they have a great deal of fondness for each other.
See, show a little taste.
See, no talking. Isn't he good? Cue Dr. Tom.
So now?
Yes, now. Lurk him. Be sure and keep your face covered.
A lot of this crewing on a low-budget movie stuff was based upon experiences I had working on low-budget slasher movies in the early 80s. And, I mean, when I got my job, I was so excited to be working on a 35mm film, and I was getting $15 a day for a 16-hour day, and it was great. And when you work on these kind of movies, everyone is there because they want to be there, because they're excited about the experience, and for a lot of them, it's their first time, and it really is the joy of movie making. And this movie was so low-budget that we couldn't afford a boom mic. So we just had a regular microphone taped to a hockey stick, and I would stand on a garbage pail, and I'm looking around me thinking, wow, I'm in the big time now. And it was that joy and that passion that we were sort of trying to communicate in these scenes showing Ed and his gang making a movie, because it's real. It's real for them.
And cut, print. We're moving on. That was perfect.
Perfect. Mr. Wood, do you know anything about the art of film production?
Well, I like to think so.
That cardboard headstone tipped over. This graveyard is obviously phony.
Nobody will ever notice that. Filmmaking is not about the tiny details. It's about the big picture.
The big picture.
It's such a delusional quality to it. And, you understand that when you make a film, you know, because you get very passionate about it, very excited about it. And you think you're making the best movie in the world. You know, you get into that weird energy. And you could see how he sort of deluded himself you know, by in his writings and his letters and all. And but I find that quite beautiful and realistic somehow. I mean, it's something that I think anybody who makes films can somewhat understand. That kind of delusional quality does help you through the film industry because, you know, it's pretty harsh. And so, I mean, you know, you try to watch, you know, what's real, what's delusional, but it's very difficult and it is somewhat of a protective mechanism. I mean, especially since his life seemed to be pretty, you know, pretty intense. So there did seem to be a pretty big gap between those things. But that's what I thought was really kind of amazing about it, too. I mean, I completely relate to the delusional aspects of it.
All right, everybody, let's get set up for scene 112. Move the crypt stage left and let's get Tor's makeup effect ready.
Guess what? What do you think you're...
What I felt good about the book was it was so contradictory. And I thought it was a very interesting way that it was a snippet from this person and then a snippet from that person, you know, and about similar events. And it sort of pieced it together in a... And again, what I thought was the most realistic, because memory, I find, is a very odd thing. I mean, the further away it gets, the more redefined it gets, or the more romanticized it gets, or the worse... You know, time has a way of changing, especially when there's heavy drinking involved. You know, it seems to change even more. So we just sort of felt that it was sort of in the spirit to give the little bits of information, but not treat it in the same... You know, most biographies, it's like straight biographies. We go, well, this happened here, and then this happened, and that happened, and in 1954, Ed did this. And, you know, we just felt like it coming through more in, like, weird asides even sometimes was better and more appropriate to the overall feeling of the true nature of memory and how people remember something or how people tell something even.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes.
This is the one scene in the movie that's basically complete baloney from start to finish.
I just wanted to...
We knew that Ed was a fan of Orson Welles, and I've always been a huge Welles fan myself, and it was so fascinating that at this point in the mid-50s, the two men were basically in the same career slump. And so we thought it would be so wonderful if the worst director of all time and the best director of all time met in a bar, had a drink, and commiserated. And so we just made it up, and we slipped it into the script, and we hoped nobody would notice. To be fair to the Heston fans, we have a misstatement in the movie where Welles makes a crack to the effect that Universal is forcing me to have Charlton Heston play a Mexican. It's a good laugh. It's a cheap laugh. In truth, let's be fair here, Charlton Heston is the one who got Orson Welles the job. So, okay, we won't get sued now.
Mr. Welles, is it all worth it?
It is when it works.
I think in this material, you can't really be too accurate because, again, you're not dealing with, like, you know, a biography of somebody who's so well known that everybody knows. These are not films that everybody has seen or everybody knows. It's just more of a rarefied group of people. And, again, I think I always felt for me, the delusional aspects of it were always the savior to it having to be any one way or another. You know, and that's perhaps my own delusional viewpoints put upon that as well.
But it's our money.
And you're going to make a bundle, but only if you shut up and let me do things my way. All right, gang.
I love the shot of his enthusiasm cutting around to the crew, barely moving, you know, started. So we kind of did the juxtaposition of Andy Hardy and a little bit of reality as well.
Action!
The recreations are hard because, you know, again, you're actually doing something that is the iconic vision, you know, and it's, I think that's quite difficult to do, but it was fun to do, and when it kind of captured it, you know, it was beautiful to see Tor crawling out of the grave, and, you know, those were, like, really accurate, and then, like, Bill's sort of, some things were a little different than the thing, but Bill got that sort of just his scene with the Plan 9, you know. All of that was very much fun to do. I mean, that was part of the energy of it.
What plan will you follow now?
Plan 9.
Plan 9.
Ah, yes. Plan 9 deals with the resurrection of the dead. Long-distance electrodes shot into the pineal and pituitary glands of the recent dead.
You know, maybe you guys were right. Plan 9 is a good title. I want that one.
And also, there's a little bit of mystique with the whole Ed Wood mythology, and I like kind of keeping it weirdly from his point of view. And his point of view all the way up until the end was that of being positive. So that it was like a twisted Andy Hardy movie, you know, was something that I enjoyed about it, because that did seem to be some aspect of his personality. And, you know, because the focus, or part focus, was his relationship with Bella, you know, we just decided, well, obviously Bella dies early, not early, but, you know, he doesn't die at the end of the film, but he kind of lives on. So we kind of felt like this was an interesting juncture to sort of end it at, because it was his most famous film, and to kind of keep the whole weirdly positive nature to it, sort of from his point of view. And this sort of felt like that was right. It sort of didn't make it like a hardcore real biography where you see every, you know,
stupid
beginning, middle, and death. It seemed in the spirit of the book. It seemed in the spirit of his character, and the, like I said, the weird, delusional but positive nature to him.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
I think with both Larry Flynt and Ed Wood, we showed people that you can, you know, there are lots of stories and an interesting the ideas behind people who were struggling in the margins, and so that, you know, allowed Behind the Music to realize they can get a full hour out of, you know, out of Thin Lizzy or Bad Company or whatever, you know, that it isn't just those 10 great bands that have a story. It's, there's a lot of bands out there that aren't as successful but have a completely fascinating history.
You know, and all these guys are just great Americana stories, because, you know, as Americans, you know, we are a country of people who can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and start out poor and become rich, and whatever you want to make of your life, you can do it in this place. And that's what these movies are about. They're just about guys who did it in really freaky ways. What's great with these anti-grape man biopics is they're full of conflict, and as a screenwriter, you want to have as much conflict with your lead character as possible, and the conflict is that these characters are wrong. They're wrong for the entire movie, but they got a burning will to prove themselves right, and so they're in conflict with all the rational people in society. Gandhi, who's going to pick a fight with Gandhi? He's right. Whatever, he's fucking Gandhi, you know.
Well, it isn't so much that, because there are a lot of people who pick fights with Gandhi.
Alright, bad example.
It's that those movies let the audience off the hook.
Who's going to think about Alexander Graham Bell?
That when you're watching great man movies, you sort of know how history has treated them, and so of course you're on the side of Gandhi. You're always going to be on the side of Gandhi. But you're not necessarily going to be on the side of Ed Wood. You're not necessarily going to be on the side of Larry Flynt. You're not going to be on the side of Andy Kaufman.
But it's fun if you can manipulate the audience enough that by the end of the film, they're rooting for Ed Wood to make a bad movie.
Right. Which is really the work of this film. I mean, that was what our job was, is that by the end of the movie, you should be totally rooting for Ed to, you know, not have his exterior shots match. You know, when those Baptists say, well, hey, it's daytime, now it's nighttime, you know, it's like, leave Ed alone.
I mean, Tim compared Ed's work a bit to folk art. You know, just saying it's primitivism, and, you know, no one is saying it's necessarily good, but isn't it just as valid as somebody, you know, with the talent of Van Gogh? Why not?
Death became greater and greater agony. The home they...
What's interesting is when you watch our movie and then watch the Ed Wood films, our movie sort of really affects the Ed Wood films themselves, where you really, if you know all the stories behind it, you know all the people, it's much harder to laugh at the Ed Wood films after seeing this movie, because this movie really, particularly Glenn or Glenda, which really now, you know, once you know the true stories, really affects you. I mean, it really feels like a piece of personal filmmaking, where you really just feel that this guy is putting a soul onto film. The old man left
that home. I think most people have some delusion in their life. I think you have it more when you're making a film, because you have to be, because in a weird way, it's, at least I find it painful. So unless I'm delusional, I probably wouldn't do it, because it's just too painful. And you know too much of the problems you're going to have. So you kind of cut that off, and you kind of get this Ed Wood-like enthusiasm to get you up to doing the project, and then through the project, and then at the end of the project, you know. And, you know, you kind of, as a filmmaker, you have to feel like you're making the best movie in the world. Because if you're not, then you're not giving it the passion it deserves and needs. But that can be a problem, because, you know, you may not be making the greatest movie. And you do get caught up in a sort of a drug-like enthusiasm. And it is a kind of a natural drug, making something, you know, making a movie. It's like it's kind of a natural high that you do get caught up in. And that's a great thing about it, but it can also be a delusional thing, you know? It can be not accurate.
Those codas were not initially part of the film. I mean, they were not in the original script, and it wasn't until actually I think Tim showed the movie to some people. And what happens whenever you do these true life stories? When the movie ends, the first thing people do when they come up to you is say, "Oh, wow, those people really exist, or what happened to them?
Is Lugosi a real person?"
And so basically, we were instructed by Tim, really, towards the last minute. I mean,
was it after that one test screening?
Yeah, I think it was after one test screening.
So it was thrown together. We had a day to do it.
Yeah, can you add some, tell us what happened to these people? And, because initially the movie ended on Jeffrey Jones. We wrote another, a coda to the first scene where he talks about Ed Wood in terms of those horror terms, and he goes back into the casket. The shot is still in there.
He says, "A man, a life. Can you prove it didn't happen?" And then he goes back in the coffin. And if you watch the movie carefully, he is talking, but you don't hear what he's saying.
Right.
I want to love the way that the music swells and the emotions swell at the very end, where actually Howard Shore had to go back in and redo the closing cue to extend it for those closing credits. And there's just a real just majesty to it as they drive away and the camera goes up, and it just, everything sort of swells so beautifully, and then it goes into the whatever happened to stuff.
Right.
So it's really nice.
It's more emotional, as opposed to giving the tip of the hat to the Ed Wood style of filmmaking. It goes with it sort of recognizes that you've grown to really care about these characters, and also winds up a lot of their stories are funny. These people continue having odd lives, you know, for 20 years after they worked with Ed.
We all agreed on that it was nice to kind of, since we kind of wanted to end it on this weird positive note, kind of, again, sort of stemming from our take on how he felt about himself and the sort of, again, the denial or the hope or whatever, is to kind of put that on there just as a slight back to reality. But even with that, you know, I still wanted to keep it positive. So musically and all, it had a sort of bittersweet quality. But to me, it just kind of brought it around to the full package, where you get still the positive side of it, the sort of uplifting side of it, but tempered with a little bit of the reality. And they wrote it with enough humor that it kind of brought it back around to the full picture to me somehow.